Well, now, it's not every day I get to talk with an individual who is so well-knowledged in so many different areas that we do on this program. And we're going to do that in a moment with Gary Grossman. And I'll tell you all about Gary when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Gary Grossman is a print and television journalist, a multiple Emmy Award-winning network television producer, a film and television historian as well. His career has included stints producing 40 television for 40 television networks. He has taught journalism, film, and television at Emerson College, Boston University, USC, Loyola Marymount University, a contributing editor to Media Ethics magazine, and also a member of the International Thriller Writers Association. He was very instrumental in doing UFO files with Bill Burns and John Greenwald. And here he is on Coast to Coast. Gary, fascinating. Good to have you with us.
For the great introduction, and I have to tell you what a fascinating, amazing, mind-bending discussion you had with Craig Hewlett. Wonderful.
Scary, was it not?
Oh, my God. Well, yeah, wonderful is not the right word. It's important to hear everything. And with your introduction to me, I pale in comparison with the work that Craig does and what your conversations are every single night. So,
well, I look forward to talking with you tonight, Gary, about so many things that you've been working on, and including your new book called Old Earth, which is fascinating as well. But give me an overview of yourself. How'd you get involved in the kinds of things that you've produced in your career?
Well, I think like many people who listen, and I've been a listener for so many years, I fell asleep as a kid with the radio in my ear. For many years, it was a shortwave broadcast coming from either England or Radio Vatican or the BBC, Voice of America, China, Radio Sophia, all around the world. And I grew up in Hudson, New York, in a small town in upstate New York, where I really learned that there was a world out there. And soon after, when I was old enough to really master Morse code, I became a ham radio operator. So instead of just listening, now I could reach out.
Yeah.
And by the time I was in high school, either on a day that the general manager of our local station was either very, very sober or very, very drunk, after I sent a letter, said, you want to do a radio show here, which is what I was asking for? Sure, come on. So I started being a broadcaster my freshman year in high school. And that led to television production in college and some documentary film work in college, working at local TV, and writing about early TV. My first book was a book on the adventures of Superman with George Reeves called Superman Serial to Serial, then a book on the history of Saturday morning TV. And it wasn't until I was in my 50s that I started writing novels, and that came out of, as everything in my life has, out of reality, what's real. I was in New York on 9/11. My business partner in our production company at that point, Weller Grossman Productions, Rob Weller and I were in New York, and someone even at the History Channel, the day before, we were there on September 10th, 2001, and someone in a meeting said, "Do you think we're running out of history?" And that was just staggering to hear that day, let alone what happened the next day. So as we drove back to Los Angeles, because we couldn't get any flight out, obviously, I started thinking about a book or a plot. If that plot was 7, 8, 9 years to put into play, what about a plot that might be 25 or 30 years in the making? And I came up with an idea for a novel, which has ultimately became Executive Actions. And you and Craig were virtually talking about it the last hour, Russian sleeper cell spies. And what does it take to install Russian sleeper cell spies in the U.S. To be awakened, who have been here for dozens of years or dozens, you know, four or five decades, yeah, to be awakened. So that was my first novel, followed by Executive Treason and Executive Command, and now Old Earth. So sprinkle in a lot of television production as well, as you mentioned, our UFO shows for the History Channel and hundreds of other shows, and a lot of the areas that you explore so well every night we did for television with History and A&E and National Geographic and Discovery.
These mysteries, Gary, are just unbelievable, aren't they?
Well, they are, and I'm a big believer in we don't know what we don't know, and it just takes another discovery. In old Earth, one of the things that just keeps coming up, and I wish I could take credit for it, I think it has to go to Carl Sagan, and that's the statement, the absence of evidence is not the evidence of absence. The absence of evidence is not the evidence of absence, meaning just because we haven't found it, or just because we've sent signals out and maybe we're waiting to hear during the broadcast tonight that, you know, here I am calling in from light years away. Just because that has not happened doesn't mean it isn't going to happen, or it has happened, but we're not accepting the facts yet.
And as you wrote Old Earth, which is a thriller, so it's fiction, but it's got a lot of truth to it, doesn't it?
Well, it sure does, and that comes from my journalism side, working for local news, and as a kid, reading the news at the local station and doing beer commercials before I could even be old enough to drink, but reading the news and trying to understand it. I firmly believe, even though my day job is principally doing documentaries, that the way to move people or the way to get people to think is to engage them as we are when we go to a movie, with a story that you're drawn into the characters. And the way you do an interview, you know, peeling the onion and revealing throughout the evening, you create drama as well and mystery all through. So that's what I've tried to do in my novel writing, and look at the stories that really jump out of the headlines, think the unthinkable, and maybe write about the unknowable. And with Old Earth, which is a departure from my political novels, or what I call political reality novels, this one deals with recorded history and questions what we know, and begs the moral question, really, if you discovered something so profound that it could destroy faith and religion, bring down governments, change life as we know it, if you had that information and you knew what it could do, what would you do with that information? Would you release it? Would you broadcast it tonight? And ultimately, that's what Old Earth is about. And that's a question that, you know, moral question that we have to ask ourselves all the time. Thankfully, there are people who weigh that. And I only have to do it in a novel. There are people who have to do it in real life.
No, that's absolutely true. I mean, we weigh as broadcasters every story, Gary, that we investigate or that comes across our desks. We weigh, is this worthy of putting on the air? And if you do, what are the consequences? What do you incite? I've wrestled with myself putting Craig Hewlett on because I've said to myself, I believe many of the things he says are true. I don't think he's a liar. I think he's pretty darn accurate in what he does. Then the question is, do you really want to upset people? Do you want to get them that frightened about things that have been going on right under their noses? And my answer to that question always has been, yes, the public deserves to know, as Jack Nicholson said in the old movie, A Few Good Men, you can't handle the truth. I think we can handle the truth.
We can. But it's the form that you choose to release it and how you do it. And you're skilled doing it. You know how. And sometimes journalists are, sometimes they're not. And recently we've been seeing journalists on television, certainly anchors, who have lost their credibility, and you wonder what else is there that we have been hearing from them.
Yes.
that we should be questioning.
I've told people, Gary, that everything I try to broadcast, I'm trying to get to the truth, except for one day, question what I do, and that's on April 1st. That's the only day I want you to say, is he telling me the truth or not? That's all.
Oh, yes. I think we all get to do that on April 1st. Well, you know, ultimately, what I love to do as a writer is look at everything around me, and that includes in all the touchstones in my life and everything that you deal with. Ancient civilizations, is there a place for that in what I write about? Yes, there was in Old Earth. UFOs, is there a place to write about that? Yes, there is, and it's in Old Earth. It was also in my documentaries. We'll be talking with John Greenwald soon, who, by the way, I'm so happy he's going to be on tonight. You've had him on many times. John was a producer and a writer and a director for me and a collaborator, really partners in the production of these UFO shows that we did for UFO Files. And I did, I based a character in Old Earth on John because I wanted to have a character who could explain the unexplainable. But even more than that, and this is pretty cool for your listeners, Coast to Coast AM is in the book.
Yeah, I love that.
And it starts with a paleontologist who has come across this amazing discovery that he can't explain. The gang is coming back from a dinner, and what do? They turn you on. And the paleontologist, who begins as a non-believer, is listening. But one of the other younger paleontologists in Old Earth says, wait a second, you know, you need to listen to this. And also, the guy he has on, a character named Robert Green, it's really John Greenwald, he might be somebody you need to talk to clarify or maybe get an opinion on what the heck we've discovered. I mean, what is this? So it by the way, it's not the first time in a second political thriller I wrote, Executive Treason, I also used you and Coast to Coast because it's a way to, where do we get information that no one else is getting? We get it on your show. And where can we begin to kind of filter out what we're hearing on other programs? On your show and begin to ask those questions. So you've been a very, very important device for my writing, and I have to thank you.
Well, thank you, Gary. That's an honor. And we're not going to stop. We're going to just try to keep plowing ahead, doing what we do. And how'd you come up with the title, Old Earth, for this book?
Well, actually, I was in upstate New York, and even at the same time that I was pounding around the radio station and doing the Morse code and ham radio operator, I was a rock hound. We grew up in an area full of limestone quarries, and everywhere you look, there were fossils, and I was tremendously interested in the fossils that I could find. And at the same time, this was the era of real interest in space, and here I was a kid who had a shortwave radio. So when Sputnik went overhead in 1957, I could hear the beep, 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 beep signal on my radio, and I could run out to the eastern sky and see it go by. And I was really, even from that time, thinking about questions that I guess a lot of kids were not thinking about. What, you know, where did we come from? How long have we been here? And what do we know? So that turned me into a science fiction fan as well as a history nut. And I just was fascinated with all of that. So when I began thinking about a new book, I thought, there's so much, again, in terms of reality, so much discussion between deep time, Earth being 4.6 million years old, and the
billion,
Earth,
billion,
billion. Billion, thank you, 4.6 billion years old. And the young earthers who will say it's 7,000 or 8,000 years old.
Yeah.
And how is that, how do we deal with that? And how can those arguments on either side be presented in a way that, for me as a writer, is not going to upset readers and turn them away, but also could, as scientists have to realize they've got to balance science and religion, how can I do that? And the other aspect of the book that's kind of fun is that I realized I didn't have a peg in real history as I first started writing it. So I began thinking, okay, 1500s, 1600s, science, religion, let me see if I can come up with a twist. And I discovered that there was a mathematician in the late 1500s, early 1600s, who had explored some caves. So I dug a little further, no pun intended, and I also discovered that this particular mathematician was one of the people credited with inventing the thermometer. And where would someone test a thermometer? And this was in Italy. Well, during the summer, outside, and then inside a cave where you
where it's cool.
Where it's cool. So lo and behold, in the very first chapter of Old Earth, this particular scientist discovers this amazing thing. Who is the scientist? He's Galileo.
Perfect.
And what he discovers, for the sake of the novel, is what ultimately points him to the stars. Now, flash forward 400 years and a half a world apart, the paleontologists in Montana make the exact same discovery. So what I deal with is an old Earth notion that travels all through the book, retrying Galileo's inquisition, at the same time peeling the onion, as it were, to get to exactly what it is they found, and ultimately that moral dilemma. And looking at the debate between science and religion and deep time and young earthers, and trying to explain even in ways, and one of the terrific, I love writing characters who begin to come up with it's like a Twilight Zone episode, George, where I kind of take dictation and the characters are telling me what to write.
Yeah.
And at one point I began thinking, well, how is it squared with those folks who believe that the man walked on the face of the earth with dinosaurs? And then take that a little bit further. How would Noah have gotten dinosaurs on the ark? I mean, these are gigantic, monstrous creations.
Yeah.
So, but then one of the characters just said, you know, basically, Gary, you know, think about this. What are you, an idiot? What would you, if you had to take on all these animals on the ark, would you take fully grown animals or babies?
I would take, this is where I come in, Gary, I would take DNA.
DNA, there you go. Even better.
Yeah.
Even better. Well, as these characters began explaining alternate views of things, and it even drilled down to NASA's concern, real concern, as you know, when we landed on the moon. Well, if the Earth, 4.6 million years old, billion years old, I keep doing that, sorry, and the moon, billions of years old, all that moon dust could be hundreds of feet deep.
Yes.
So
that's what they were concerned about when they landed on the moon. They thought the astronauts were just going to sink away into the dust.
Absolutely. And the fact that they didn't gave rise to young earthers to say, look, there's a reason it's only 7,000 years old. So I go back and forth with all of those things, as well as the intrigue of secret societies, which, of course, I've done documentaries on. And I don't know if you've ever explored, it's a great story, a guy named Jasper Maskelyne.
Hold on. Let's talk about that. We're going to bring John Greenwald in as well, and you can explain to us how you weaved him into your book, Old Earth. We'll be back. Well, you know, I'm being bid for dinner. That's right. We're doing a benefit with our Los Angeles station, KFI AM 640, with the American Red Cross and the California Earthquake Authority. We're raising funds for disaster preparedness. And my gosh, in California, it could happen at any day. And anyways, so far, somebody has bid $3,000 to have dinner with me. And this runs through April 30th. So if somebody wants to bid a little higher than that, just go ahead. The link is at coasttocoastam.com. And right under the highlights there, you'll see the link to KFI and the Red Cross. Click that and go ahead and bid. It's for a great cause. And we'll be back in a moment more with Gary Grossman and his work, Old Earth, on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast, Gary Grossman with us. We're going to bring John Greenwald in just a moment. Gary, you were talking about Jasper.
Yes,
who is Jasper?
Oh, wonderful story. Again, a character who we discovered and did a documentary on for the History Channel. Jasper Maskelyne was a British magician, 1930s, 1940s, and he enlisted in the service in England and said, "You need me." And they said, "Well, you're a magician, sure, you can entertain the troops." He said, "No, you really need me." And he very quickly demonstrated how and why they needed him. He went to North Africa, and among the things that he did was moving the port of Alexandria, literally, or maybe I would say figuratively, moving the port of Alexandria. When the German Luftwaffe came in to bomb it, they destroyed the port of Alexandria, but not the real one. What did he do as a magician? He created, a couple of clicks off on the compass, another port of Alexandria on a smaller scale. The lead bomber coming in looked at his compass and said, "This isn't where it should be, but I see the lights of the port of Alexandria ahead." So he steered his bomber, German bomber. The other German bombers followed the lead bomber. And night after night, because of a magician's trick, they bombed the fake city with all the lights off in the real city and all the lights on in a small-scale fake city. And he did numerous other things. Why is this kind of still important to me? Well, it figures in very definitely to Old Earth. And again, one of the things I like to do in my novels are find those real touchstones that involve people in either our lifetime or recent lifetime whose experience and events and stories can really resonate through characters now. But Jasper Maskelyne, just an amazing character. Some wonderful, wonderful material has been written up on him. But I'm not sure, John, you'll have to remind me, John Greenwald, if you worked on that show. I know we did, of course, all of our UFO shows.
Let's bring in John Greenwald. John, of course, heads up the popular website, theblackvault.com, and he's a regular guest here on Coast to Coast. Go ahead, John. Welcome.
Well, thank you. It's good to be on with you again, George, and you too, Gary. Thank you for that. No, that particular show, I think, was War Illusionist, if I remember the
yes,
Weller Grossman Productions.
War Illusionist.
Well, yeah, that was prior to my time joining you guys. I think you did that a few years prior to me coming aboard.
Okay. Well, you sure did fabulous work on our UFO shows, and as I was explaining to George and the listeners, the ability to craft a character after what you do with the Black Vault, with breaking news even today that I read online, it was an honor and it was an amazing thing to do, because here you have been responsible for so many documents being released and knowledgeable in so many areas that for me to craft a character who everyone else can go to and can sort out what the conspiracies are and what some of the ancient civilizations that existed tens and hundreds of thousands of years ago, when and even further back as Old Earth deals with in the time of the Pangaea, with a single continent, it was just wonderful to be able to create that character and then have you on Coast to Coast. And now here we are. This is life imitating art or art imitating life? I'm not sure, George.
And tell us how you weaved John into your book, Old Earth.
Well, John was on the show, on Coast to Coast, and our characters, principal characters, were listening and heard dynamic conversation, as you have every single night. The principal character, Dr. Quinn McCauley, was a skeptic and was ready to poo-poo it. But after he makes a discovery in a cave in Montana, his younger students say, "Wait a second, you know, we don't know what we've just found, but I think somebody else named Robert Greene in the book can help sort this out." So they go visit him in Bakersfield, California. So, John, I didn't quite have him at your home in Los Angeles area. but in Bakersfield,
California. I'll take Bakersfield. I could think of worse places to live.
And what happens there is an extension of what happened on Coast to Coast in the conversation. They come in as skeptics, and they leave as believers. Because
that's true.
They've just opened their eyes. The same way you can open your eyes, 2 days ago in the New York Times, there was a story about a discovery in Italy. A fellow has been digging down in his villa trying to fix a toilet. And what did he come into and what did he find? Well, he was trying to get to the sewage pipe. Virtually underground city.
Yeah, it was a tunnel of a town, wasn't it?
Absolutely right.
Yeah.
Well before the birth of Jesus, Roman granary, Franciscan chapel, etchings from the Knights Templar, and you know, that's just one of many stories. Recently, I also read about a city that was discovered in Honduras with ground-penetrating radar that dates back 1,500 more years, and in Turkey, another excavation discovered another city where that was 4,000 years old. Well, what makes us think that it even doesn't go back further? It can. It does. And that's what John's character does in the book. And by the way, that's what he did in our production.
I was going to say, that's John.
Yes.
Well, what's very cool about going through Old Earth and Gary's book, because I'm going to be blatantly honest with you, Gary, and I hope you don't take offense to this. When you told me that there was a character modeled after me, I thought I was going to read something that had absolutely like no connection to me whatsoever. I really didn't think that there would be a lot of kind of synergy between me and this character. And I'm reading through it, and you know, you're talking about Robert Greene doing Freedom of Information Act requests and collecting government documents, and you know, kind of going after the secrets that we don't really hear about every day. And I'm kind of reading this and going, wow, Gary really meant what he said. I didn't really believe that. So it was actually very cool for me to see that, because obviously that's been my life's work. I mean, I've been doing this now since I was 15, and that's when I first created the blackvault.com, and here I am 18 years later and 1.4 million pages later. And, you know, it's just kind of very cool to have that. I don't know if legacy is the right word, but just kind of what I've built now in your book. And that it was just a very kind of surreal thing reading through that and reading that story. And it was truly appreciated on my end, for sure.
Hey, John, and while we have you for a few moments here, give us an update on what's going on with the Black Vault, if you could.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, last time you and I were on, some drama happened. Well, I got all of those Project Blue Book documents onto the internet,
right.
And there was about 140,000 pages, and I started compiling all this stuff, and that kind of turned into a very dramatic thing because a very major corporation decided to try and pull a copyright claim on public documents, if you can believe that. It was a very frustrating situation. Why would a company, and this is part of the public record on the internet because they said it publicly, but Ancestry.com actually tried to shut everything down, which they were successful in doing. So that was a little bit of drama. But that aside, and that frustration aside, the site's doing very, very well. The UFO case file database is back online. That's growing considerably. Invite anybody who wants to submit any reports to do so. But you can see hundreds and hundreds of cases in the blackvault.com. And as Gary mentioned, too, even just today, there's been a lot of headlines away from the UFO material, a lot of headlines lately about some of my discoveries of government secrets outside of the paranormal realm. Most notably, recently, there was a document that I was able to get declassified. It was released many years ago, but it was very, very heavily redacted. It was blacked out. And this was about the reason why we went into Iraq and what the reasoning was for the Iraq War. And I was actually very successful in getting that document that was released years ago re-reviewed by the government. I requested what's called a mandatory declassification review and got them to actually declassify a lot of it. And that became major news here in the last month. So
Yeah, give us the highlights.
Very, very well. It's just that the minute I think, oh, everything's kind of stagnant and there's not going to be much going on, all of a sudden I'll get a document in the mail the next day, put it online, and it blows up and it becomes a headline somewhere. So it's never a dull moment in the Black Vault.
And John, give us an update on that. Why you think we went into Iraq?
You know, wow, this is where I wrestle between my investigator hat and just my personal opinion. You know, I don't think it's a bad thing of what we did. Did bad things happen? Absolutely. War is never smooth. It's never perfect. But I think the world's a better place after what happened. However, now my investigator hat goes on. Personal opinion aside, the documentation really kind of shows that there was no reason to go, that a lot of the reasoning that we were led to believe wasn't necessarily true. Now, there was still intelligence, and there was other documents that came out that shows that there were weapons of mass destruction, the infamous WMDs, the elusive WMDs that, you know, half the world says weren't there, half the world says yes, there was. Well, there are documents that show that, well, there actually was. Were they these grandiose, you know, weapons that could be launched against America? Well, no, but there was something there. So it's a very interesting topic because you can actually really debate by using real evidence, not an opinion, but you can really kind of debate both sides of this very easily. So it was kind of interesting to get that publicity because what I've talked about, again, personal opinion-wise, actually was kind of contrary to what the documentation says. Again, not right, not wrong. It was just this is what the documentation says. So again, you can argue both sides. I personally believe it wasn't a bad thing, although bad things happened. Bad decisions were made, absolutely. I would never argue that, but, you know, it's I think the world's a better place. So, and the world is constantly evolving, constantly changing, and we're kind of constantly learning and evolving as a society to make these kind of tough decisions. So, you know, mistakes are made all the time, and I think the documentation shows that, history shows that, but it's always fun for me to kind of come out with the documents, and if it contradicts what my personal opinion is, hey, so be it. I'll put it out there anyway. You know, I've been proven wrong and called worse before, so not a problem on my end. I just love to get it out there and really kind of create dialogue is what I love to do most.
All right, great. John, thanks for being on the program. Let's stay in touch. John Greenwald from The Black Vault. Gary, back to you and the old Earth. Michael Cremo believes that mankind might be hundreds of millions of years old, which kind of echoes some of the things you've talked about.
Well, it does. And as I got more and more into research, I would just find these nuggets that would be wonderful, and it would just take me to places and again, think the unthinkable. There was one a few years back, a study in Nature that offered evidence that even 3.2 billion years ago, there were forms of life that were at that point able to pull nitrogen out of the air. And nitrogen is crucial to the formation of our genetic material. So could that have led to a species developing over a period of time like that? And one after another, I would find these different studies that said, yes, there was opportunity for life to exist, maybe not as we know it, and maybe, you know, often explained in alien terms, but life could have existed. How much of that would still exist today? What kind of evidence would there be? And gets back to your question about the title of Old Earth and the ultimate question, if a civilization existed hundreds of millions of years ago, and knowing that they were dying and virtually or all of their artifacts would be gone, how would you or how would they have left their footprints in the sand? What clues would they have given us? And I have to thank my son Jake, who's actually listening tonight in Boston in school. He came across a wonderful, wonderful thing, an invention called Avanta Black. This is a fabric developed in England that absorbs 99.965% of all light. Light's just absorbed. It It is the blackest black that we know. It's like a black hole on Earth, and yet it's a fabric. It is so black that you really can't perceive it.
Huh.
I use that as a device, as a link to be able to get to the possibilities that I raise. And then I added another thing, and that is, how would we communicate? What is the universal language that would cover all time as it covers all space? Well, the answer for that was in Carl Sagan's work. The answer for that was in Voyager. The answer for that is in our communication blast out with SETI. It's prime numbers. Prime numbers are math's most mysterious figures, and they've existed for all time.
Understandable throughout the universe.
Throughout the universe. So those two things, and it's not spoiler alerts for old Earth readers, but these real things become critical in fiction that ultimately drive a greater understanding about everything around us, and again, the possibilities that I get into and that you open up every single night, every night. And it's fascinating for me as a writer, but as I mentioned, in that kind of Twilight Zone world, it's really weird when the characters take over, and I feel like I'm just taking dictation, because I somehow have to connect with Rod Serling and find out what all that's about.
Well, he was a genius, wasn't he?
He was a great writer.
Did you ever have a chance to meet him?
No, I didn't, but I was mentored and became very good friends for many years with Gene Roddenberry.
Ah.
And in that regard, I was able to hang my stars on one of the great minds and people who changed 20th century thinking and whose work continues to live on. When I was teaching at Emerson College in Boston, I wrote him a letter. This was in the early 1970s. I had no business teaching at that point. I was far too young, but I had a job teaching and was happy to do it. But I thought, how about using Star Trek in a class to talk about contemporary issues, hatred, balance of power, racial inequality? It's what Star Trek dealt with. And I wrote a blind letter, just, you know, an unsolicited letter to Gene Roddenberry. And a week later, I got a call. A switchboard called up to my office and said, Gary, there's a Mr. Roddenberry on the line for you. Oh, my God. And he said yes. And every week we used an episode and explored the issues in a seminar. The fire marshal fortunately never came to the room. We were probably rated for 100 people, and every week we had about 300 people in the room. But it was fabulous. So no on Rod Serling, but yes on Gene Roddenberry.
Back in my L.A. office, Gary, I've got a letter from Ray Bradbury.
Oh, who I share a birth date with.
Classic. Oh, man.
Oh, my gosh.
We did an editorial about him in one of our newsletters. On his Twilight Zones, I sing The Body Electric, and he just loved it and sent a little thank you. We're going to come back, talk more, Gary, about your work, Old Earth, and we'll take phone calls on Coast to Coast AM.